Good morning. Wow, by the way, I run hot. You want to turn me down a little bit so we don't kill all these poor people back here. How's everyone? Good, good, good. Got it. Those of you who don't know me, my name is Chris Jackson. I work in the U.S., and I'm the worldwide lead for enterprise application compatibility and modernization. It's kind of what I do as a day job, and a lot of what we come across with in the context of compatibility and keeping apps working and really telling the whole platform story delves deeply into internals. And probably there's nothing that's been more impactful to the ability to applications to keep running than the changes we've been making in security. And at the same time, we have this sort of ongoing challenge with people not really understanding what's going on the platform. So the intent of this session is to really go deep on all the things that we've been doing over the course really of the past decade almost that transforms the way we traditionally think about security. If you came to this talk last year, it's largely the same talk. So you're not gonna hurt my feelings if you're like, oh, I don't need that again. But if you've not been, hopefully it'll be a pretty fun ride as we sort of tour through. See, he was here before. He's like, yeah, I wanted something different. Yeah, you told me. See, now you didn't waste your time. That's how it works. We're going to go as deep as we possibly can. And in fact, my friend Ant, who runs this track, Windows and I don't know, PC, who knows what he does. I'm surprised he has a job, honestly. He's also introducing a concept that we do internally. And that concept is called hardcore. And it's something that we've been piloting, and we're actually just on the second delivery at our internal conferences. The premise is this. Just because you've already mastered what you're doing doesn't mean you're not entitled to continue learning. And I believe very passionately about that. So this really is designed for people who have a pretty good sense of where security begins, but just haven't gone burrowing deep inside of Windows to get what's going on. For those of you who are here, we are going to show some code. You don't have to understand the code to get the concepts, but you'll have the opportunity to do that. We're going to get into a debugger. We're going to really see what's going on and try and explore it. We're going to cover really things that have been happening since Windows Vista that, by and large, developers don't get. So, are we all agreed that that's the ride we signed up for? Then away we go. So, of course, we start in our console mode debugger. One of the things that comes up pretty regularly, how many of you feel that you've seen enough PowerPoint slides so far? Because they actually, really? Some of you are like, I want more PowerPoint. Because there's like five of you like, yeah, you know what? I don't need any more PowerPoint. My goal was originally to not do any PowerPoint slides at all. And it turns out that at Microsoft, there's a rule that you have to use PowerPoint. I mean, who knew that that was the case? So we're going to go ahead and get PowerPoint started using the typical command line that you guys all use to start up PowerPoint. So start with set window text W, and then we'll EZU. We're going to modify the EAX register. This is how you guys start PowerPoint, right? We'll go ahead and do an escape a quote, untitled PowerPoint, and we'll unescape that guy, and we'll disable all of our breakpoints, and we'll go conditionally, just like you normally start PowerPoints, and go ahead and get that started. And naturally, that's going to take a hugely long time. Why do you think that might be the case? Because Windows updates came out today, and now I'm downloading all of the new symbols. So PowerPoint will eventually start for us. We'll have to wait for that to happen. In the interim, we're going to go all the way back to the start of what happened back in the days of Windows Vista and try to make sure everyone's on the same page. And the reason why I go back that far, oh, there we go, PowerPoint. So now we are technically obeying the rules. Here's what we're going to cover, right? We're going to cover tokens and elevated tokens. That's a really small PowerPoint. Let's go ahead and change that. Let's change the font. We'll bump that up to maybe 20 point. That should be good. Tokens and elevated tokens. Yeah, that's a good time to do that right now. Just pop right on up. And then we're going to kind of go through and talk about integrity levels and explain what those are and really go under the covers to make sure that everyone gets that top to bottom. We're going to cover user interface privilege isolation, another Windows Vista era technology that's deeply misunderstood. and then we're going to finish our way into what we do in Windows 8, specifically in the Windows Store applications with capabilities, explain what those are and how that affects the security system, and then talk about app containers and the sandbox mechanism that built into Windows itself. So that's the tour that we're going to take. Now, when we start off, I'm going to start off by taking a look at what a token is. So the fundamental to the security mechanisms that happen, it all begins with a token. Who are you? What are you allowed to do? And the notion that everyone, I assume, gets, because we assume you know what you're doing if you show up to a session that's titled this, is that we do authentication and authorization based upon identity. Who are you and what groups do you belong to? And this is a way for me to spit that out. So when I look at who I am North America WAC CJAX. That's who I am, and I'm represented to all of these systems by this SID. And that SID tells everyone who I am. So when I make a decision, it can bounce it off. Well, does Chris Jackson specifically have access to this? Or does anything that Chris Jackson belongs to have access to it? And that will presumably, after this reaches out over the Pacific Ocean, this demo goes a little bit quicker when I'm not in New Zealand, will show me all of the things that I belong to. Now, one of the things that I do for convenience, oh, there we go, spit everything out. Let's go back up to the top. One of the things I do for convenience, because this is a convenience feature, not a security feature, is that I belong to the administrators group. How many of you just run a standard user all the time and don't even belong to admins group? Also, a small percentage, you, not everyone. So most of you run as admins all the time. How many of your users, how many of you have initiatives where you're trying to get more and more of your users to run standard user and not have admin rights at all anymore? Right? Really dominant trend in the industry, right? So the idea behind UAC is let's even let administrators look like standard users most of the time. And that's what this whole split token concept is doing. So I have this administrator's token, but look at this attribute that's tagged onto the end here. Group is used for deny only. That's a flag not a lot of people know about. This means that I cannot use this to grant me access to any resources. I can only use it to deny me access. So if I want to copy something into program files, the access control list says, nope, you can't unless you're an admin. I'm an admin, but I have it flagged as deny only. Whereas if I were to run this as admin, who am I? Format that as a list. I will see that entry show up. Nice and small, as a fully enabled group. So we start off by filtering off who we are, and we have this concept of splitting things off. The question is, how does that happen exactly? And that's a mechanism that not a lot of people understand. So here's how it works. So WinLogon is what gets launched when you're going through and creating that process. And when we log you on, what we first create is your elevated token, which has the token the same way it would have been back in the glorious days of Windows XP. Oh, don't we miss those days? Then we'll go through and make a second logon session with your filtered token. And what we do is we go in and we take that admin group and we flag it for deny only so that it can't be used for that. The other thing we do is we go through and remove a bunch of privileges that are really dangerous. So when we go to the bottom of my token here, I see all the groups that I belong to, right? And I belong to entirely too many. Clearly, I'm doing too much work and need a raise. Go ahead and tell my manager that, right? At the very bottom, we see the list of all the privileges that I have. So let's talk about what privileges are and kind of set alignment here. What do standard users get to do as a general rule? launch applications. Let's take it even higher, right? If I think about what does it mean to be a standard user can do whatever they want to their own stuff. They can't screw around with other people's stuff. And it really is kind of fundamentally, eventually boils down to that. You can write to my documents. Why? Because it's your stuff. You can't write to program files. Why? Because everyone else shares that stuff. It doesn't belong to you. And that's really what it all boils down to, right? I can launch them because it doesn't hurt anybody else's stuff. I can't modify them because it hurts other people. And if you think of it that way, you can start to intuit your way to most of the things that they can do. Well, what do privileges mean? Privileges mean here's things I'm going to give you the ability to do that extend beyond those permissions. If I shut down the computer, clearly that impacts any other user on the computer because suddenly it's turned off. But if I can't shut down my computer, it's kind of not real useful to me. So I give you the privilege to do that even though it transcends that boundary. Undocking the same way. It's going to affect another user because suddenly the computer's walking away. But if I don't give you that privilege, what are you going to do? Your stupid Windows, you're just going to yank it off the docking station anyway. And we haven't stopped anything. So we give you these explicit privileges, and including the last one, which is my favorite one, because it resolves an issue that I personally got yelled at for. In a hotel in Minneapolis, Minnesota, in the U.S., where someone walks up to me, she's like, I had a Microsoft shirt on. I now no longer wear Microsoft shirts for this reason, because you get randomly yelled at sometimes. She walks up, sees the Microsoft shirt, and she starts cursing at me. She's like, I am in a different time zone, and my clock is wrong because of you. Like, because of me. That was my decision. Okay. But it's true. If you run as a standard user on Windows XP, you can't change your time zone. Why? Because changing the system time is an admin level permission. Why might it be an admin level permission? Kerberos authentication will break if you're not within plus or minus 5 minutes of the server. Probably from a security perspective, just as important is deniability, repudiability. I can change my clock, do something naughty, change the clock back, and then be somewhere else visibly away from the computer when that naughty thing supposedly happened because of my changed clock, and then deny that I did that thing and have the videotape to prove it. Right? There's some very serious security considerations behind doing it. Denial of service, which you point out, as well as non-repudiability. Two big problems. So it is an admin right. Changing your time zone can really annoy people. By the way, Newfoundland's off by like 15 minutes. That way really confuses people. So if you're actively trying to confuse people, that's an awesome way to do it. But that's all you really do is annoy people. So we made it a privilege and gave it to everyone because it's really irritating to travel and not be able to change your time zone. So you have these privileges, and we take away all of the privileges that you would normally have as an admin. We strip those out as well. So things like the SE backup privilege. What does SE backup do? I can read anything I want to on the file system without an access check. SE restore, I can write anything I want to without an access check. SE debug, I need that to debug programs, right? Wrong. I need it to debug other people's programs. My developers don't need SE debug to do their job. They need SE debug to get into somebody else's process and debug that. All of those are admin level rights, and we strip those away in building that token, and we make that your filtered token, and then we go through and we create explorer.exe using your filtered token. And how tokens work in Windows is you inherit your token and your environment block and everything else from your parent process. You get a copy of what they had. Most things have at the root of their tree explorer.exe, so things by default run with your filtered token. So that's how it kind of gets started. Now, we start it that way. What's an impact of this architecture that some people notice? Well, a big one is, what if you are using mapped network drives? Now, in the Windows team, right, so part of my job, just to kind of level set here, my job is to represent to the Windows team when they go completely batshit crazy and say, don't do that, because people get irritated when you do that. And they don't believe that anyone on planet Earth uses drive letters anymore. How many of you still use drive letters? Yeah, everyone. Yeah, we don't see that. And so what happens as a result of this architecture is these are separate logon sessions. Where do we store your map network drives? In the context of your logon session. You've got two of them. This was always true. You can try it. Go to Windows XP, because I know you've still got one somewhere. Log in. Go to runas.exe and make a second copy of the exact same U. And if you don't run a script, you won't have the same map network drives. It was always true. It's part of the architecture of how we made Windows. Now you just do it a whole lot more often if you run with the UAC turned on. That's the difference. A result of the architecture. We didn't change anything. We just changed the frequency of something happening. So the next question is, well, how do I elevate, and what's the possible impact of that? Well, if I'm elevating, the first things first, I always have to go through shell execute to get an elevation to happen. So we go down to the API level. So if you're not a dev nerd, you can kind of tune out the fact that there's a Windows API on the screen. It's okay. But there are two different ways you can make a new process in Windows. Create process and its variations, and shell execute. What's the difference? If I go through create process, I can't elevate. Well, why the heck would that be? And that comes down to the fact that we have been going through and re-architecting all of Windows. Oh, whoops, that was not on purpose. Let's see if I can use my computer. Re-architecting Windows into a series of layers. And we did that because it became really hard to service Windows the way that it was currently put together. You couldn't figure out which one to compile first. In fact, I don't know if you remember a news story probably 10, 15 years ago where a lot of the NT4 source code was leaked by somebody. And a lot of the lawyers were really, really angry, right? But the engineers were like, watch the community. If you see anyone who's actually able to get that to compile, we'll hire them for the Windows build team. It was that hard to do. So we started saying, listen, we're going to have layers 0 and 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and so forth. If you're in layer 0, the only thing you can depend upon is other layer 0 components. We're trying to de-spaghettify the Windows code base. Layer 1 can depend on 1 or 0. Layer 2 can depend on 2 or 1 or 0. And you can start to see some of this already. If you've gone spelunking into the Windows binaries, you may have noticed a new one sitting in there called kernelbase.dll. That was a result of this refactoring work. We had to start separating them apart and being able to say what would be the minimum. We had an experimental version of Windows called MinWin, which was designed to take away as much as we possibly could, yet still have something we could feasibly call Windows. We have a shipping product on the server side called Server Core that strips away a lot of Windows. That's the goal. Here's the thing. Create process is a very, very low-level component. What can you do in Windows without a process? Next to nothing. What can you do in Windows without all of the things that make elevation possible, like services and the GUI that consent.exe leverages to ask the user yes or no and group policy? You can do a lot without that. So create process can't take a dependency on elevation bits that happen up higher up. Can't be done. Disallowed. So we have to go through shell execute to make that happen. Shell execute will call into the app info service. The app info service, my handwriting is not so great, so apologies for that. The app info service will go and check your group policies, and it will see what you're allowed to do and possibly go into consent.exe to figure out if the user wants to or not. Doesn't actually have to give you a prompt. People always equate UAC with prompts. It's a whole lot more than prompts. Consent.exe is the only part of the prompt process. If you say yes or the group policies say yes, then we will create your new process and reparent it so that it looks like whoever initially called shell execute was the actual parent. But you're not actually there. And the one side effect I've ever seen from this is that, as mentioned before, what do you get from your payment process? Well, the token, but we gave you a new token. We gave the elevated one, so we know that's going to be different. And your environment block. Who's the parent process? The app info service. So you get app info's environment block and not your applications. And I have seen a couple of instances where people have gone through and said, I'm going to pass information to my child process through environment variables or what have you, and they don't make it there if you elevate. That's why. It's just Windows operating as Windows does, and that all sort of makes sense. So that's how it all comes together. Now, I mentioned along the way that it does get impacted by group policy. And I wanted to kind of point out, assuming I can actually get this very small bar targeted here, in the Windows settings and then security settings, this always takes entirely too long on my machine to roll through, how it's configurable, because it is not exclusively UAC as prompts and it can do whatever it wants to do. What is important is that you have the right strategy and understand what the consequences are of whatever decisions you make. When it comes to prompting, you really have a binary decision. If I'm an admin, what can I do? If I'm an admin, I can either automatically say yes, indeed that is an option. So if I go down to the bottom here and take a look at the options under UAC, behavior for admins, my choices are I can automatically elevate. In fact, if you go to the slider in Windows 8 and turn it all the way down, we don't turn it off anymore. We just turn it off to automatically approve everything that asks for it. So you never see a prompt again, for good or for evil. They go away. I can prompt you and either ask you to type your password, because who doesn't like typing their password a whole bunch of times, or just say yes or no, or I can just do it for non-Windows binaries, right? And the specifics of that are, we looked that you're digitally signed by a Windows signature, and that you included a manifest that specifies, hey, I don't accept command line arguments. It's okay. No one can use me for evil. So there's some rules. So there are some Windows binaries that'll still prompt you, like regedit, because they accept command line arguments. So therefore, they don't have that manifest bit. So that's how all of that works. It's all configurable. For standard users, there are a lot fewer choices. It's all about, hey, do I just ask you to type in someone else's credentials or just automatically say no? And in typical Windows style, the way we say no is along the lines of, this program is blocked by policy, so we don't give you any real clue as to what the source of that is, because that's how Windows rolls. But those are the choices that I have. So bringing that down to a strategy, we're going to kind of start spelunking again, but I want to raise it back up to the strategy part. Here's something important to think about as you start to bring this all together, if you're not familiar with these options, and decide what you're going to do. Really, it's, I think you're kind of probably overly optimistic about the patience of your users if you make them type a password, because they're probably going to get really angry. In fact, there's a terrific article, a paper that was written by someone in Microsoft Research, the title of which is So Long and No Thanks for All the Fish, The Rational Rejection of Security Guidance by End Users, that will outright state, yes, it's more secure technically if it weren't for the fact that the distributed cost that you're not accounting for is so massive in whatever security settings you put together. So saying no or accelerating it, the fastest way, the way you can be least intrusive, tends to be the more secure choice, because otherwise people find the way around it. The next one is, what do you do about whether or not I go on the secure desktop? The secure desktop options, which you can kind of see showing up here, put me on the secure desktop. That's a really poor circle. That's an equally poor circle. I am really winning on the circles today. On the secure desktop, yes or no, here's why that matters. If I'm on the secure desktop, remote access software tends not to remote the secure desktop for you. So, who has the credentials? Your help desk. You put something on the secure desktop. What's not being remoted to the help desk? The place where you type those credentials. The only person who sees it is the person who doesn't have the password. not very helpful. MSRA.exe will remote the secure desktop for them. As far as I have found, nothing else on the planet does. So if you're doing remote elevation from your help desk, you almost always end up having to turn off secure desktop. Rather conveniently, we make you do that in a couple of different places, just for extra bonus. Why did we do that? Legacy reasons. We added the ability to turn it off, we added the slider in Windows 7, and to support the slider, we made the group policies a little bit uglier. It's unfortunate that that's how it works, right? But that's one of those trade-off decisions we made. Keep the existing group policies, so your Windows Vista policies, because who didn't deploy Vista, stay in place. No chuckles at that? Come on, no one deployed Vista. Although, believe it or not, I was with a large government customer where they still had machines running Windows ME. Yeah, that was awesome. I was a little bit surprised by that. So that's kind of the group policy. So I wanted to kind of dive through. We've got these tokens. We've got admins and non-admins and split tokens and all of this stuff that's happening. And so the next question is, all right, elevation, why does it happen? When does it happen? And to get into that, I'm going to pull a tool from the AppCompat toolkit. So this tool is called Compatibility Administrator, and it's what we use to fix busted apps in the AppCompat world. And when we look at what we have here, I'm going to load up this application list to get started. How do we find broken apps? And how do we make it elevate, right? So elevation happens for one of three reasons. Number one, the developer asked for it. So if you're writing code, how many of you write code, actually? How many do we have developers in the audience? So about less than a quarter of you. How many of you have never written code in your life and hope you never have to? Another quarter of you. What do the rest of you do? You're like, I end up sometimes do it. When you write code, you have the ability to put in a bit of XML, and Visual Studio will do it for you, that will say, whoever I am is fine. That's called run as invoker. I'd like to be admin, right? As require administrator. And then there's, you know what, yeah, whatever. You know, if you have admin rights, I'll take them. If not, I won't, right? It's called highest available, three choices. The developer can explicitly put that in there. So option number one, why something would elevate, the developer said, hey, I'd like to have elevation. Option number two, the IT administrator using this very tool, compatibility administrator, can put in there, this program needs to elevate, right? So require administrator as invoker or highest available, they can do all of the same stuff. The IT admin can make a vote as well. And for those of you who do administer devices, guess whose vote wins if both people cast a vote? The admin, yeah. So someone can vote. But here's the thing, not everyone votes. Particularly when we first introduced it, and nobody had voted because a feature didn't exist. We had to figure out what to do. And we had to figure out with a bit of priority because we looked at the compatibility statistics. And in the Windows group, we actually have, at the time in Vista when we added this feature, we had about 1,000 applications we tested every day with every build of Windows where we compare whether they worked on XP and whether they worked on Vista. When we got to Windows 7, it was about 3,000. For Windows 8, it was about 5,000. For 8.1, it was approaching 6,000, and it keeps getting bigger. We just write more and more tests against more and more apps so that we see the compatibility impact because compatibility matters. In Windows Vista, the Beta 1 builds did have UAC bits in them, but it was off by default. The Beta 2 build, so literally the day we shipped Beta 1, the next build became the first Beta 2 build, and the last one became actual Beta 2. That's when we enabled it by default. So the Beta 1 builds, the compatibility metrics we saw were at about 96% of apps that worked on XP still worked on Vista. The next day, we enabled UAC by default. How do you think we did? Went to about 20%. So we're like, oh, so we're just going to break 4 out of 5 pieces of software immediately. That's probably not going to fly. And the big problem we had, I mean, there are several things we did in terms of systematic fixes in the OS, but the first one was things need to install. How do we install them? Let's spot all existing installers. How do you spot all existing installers? Well, we just go and look for some clues that are fairly subtle. Here's the first one. They actually are shown in Compatibility Administrator if I look at what's on my system. We look for, hey, you've got an internal name or an original file name or a file description of setup, or for those who speak Japanese, seto appu. In both full width and half width katakana, we'll catch both of those. The company name is setup. Scroll me down. Yes, and even the file name itself includes the word setup. You can try this. Take any random binary you want to, throw the word setup in there, and you'll see a UAC shield pop right on there. That's how we detect them. Setup. Update. Look for the word update. Patch. We actually exclude add patch, dispatch, dispatcher, WI dispatch, but we catch all of that. And, let me go home. Oh, come on. And installer detection is the last one. Four things that we look for, and you can actually see the specific details inside of Compatibility Administrators. It's really very simple. There's nothing really sophisticated here. And guess what happens? False positives happen all the time. My favorite false positive ever was when we first put it out there, and I was talking to a little company called Flexera. How many of you know a company called Flexera? How many of you know a product that they build? There's Admin Studio and there's Install Shield. Guess what the entire Install Shield division's applications trigger? Every single one of them is detected as a setup by Windows. All of them. Everything prompts. It was the worst prompting experience you've ever seen because of the historical name of the company. They all prompt. So false positives happen all the time. So I point this out because it's really important. This app is prompting. How do I get it to elevate without seeing the prompt? And the first question I have is, does it actually need elevation or is it prompting because we think it's a setup? Because that's what happens more often. If it's prompting because we think it's a setup, you can apply the specific non-installer fix to make that go away. So it is absolutely possible to get past that if I go into the fixes. One of the fixes we have is specific non-installer. Here it kind of is. Right? And if I apply that fix, the prompt goes away. You don't have admin rights, but you've made the prompt go away. Now you can see whether or not the app works and whether the fixes apply to it. Okay? So far, so good? All right, we're going to go back down into the mines a little bit, and we're going to talk about the next aspect. So we have tokens, we have who I am, who I belong to. Let's go ahead and clean up my windows here. That's a lovely PowerPoint. I love that. Greatest software program ever. And talk about the next aspect, something called integrity. Because I said we've been making these authorization decisions based upon identity, not based upon trust. The concept of integrity is to introduce a dimension of trust. Do I trust this application? So I'm going to use the PSExec utility from SysInternal. So those of you who don't know it, it's really handy for all kinds of stuff. And I'm going to launch a version that looks nothing like PowerPoint, a little application called Notepad. But I launched it with this little command line argument here called dash L. And what that does is it launches it at low integrity. So let's go ahead and take a look at this integrity column. We'll use the find window thing here. And I have added the integrity column. We'll go ahead and sort by it. So you'll notice there's a few in there. There's system, high, medium, and low, which is what I just launched Notepad as. Four different categories. So technically, the integrity level itself is represented to the system. If I go to the security tab, it's represented to the system as a SID. And here is the SID for low, 4096. And internally, we represent it as a 32-bit number, which means technically there are 4 billion different possible integrity levels. We use 4 primarily, right? Giving us 4 billion minus 4 to work with still if we ever decide to expand it in the future. But we kind of grouped them together. System, something running as a service. High, something running as admin. medium, standard user, low, sandboxed. You can start to think of it that way, right? It's these different tiers of your applications working together, implemented as a SID. And the SID gets specially treated by the algorithm that we use for access check to determine whether or not you're allowed to do something. So this is how we determine what you're allowed to do, is based upon this identity. And we say, you know, based upon this and a policy, what you're allowed to do. Every process has an integrity level. If you don't have one, you're automatically going to land at medium, but it's going to get injected every time. You always have that SID. Every token has an integrity level SID. Every securable object does not necessarily have an integrity label applied to it, which is how you compare them, or an integrity policy. But the policy just basically says, I have this label, and what do I do if you land in below it? It is always protecting me from beneath, not from above. So if I have medium integrity, I can do no read up, no write up, no execute up. No read up means anything below me, so if a medium, that would be low, can't read anything in this file, if it's a file, for example. No write up means I can't write to it. No execute up means I can't call it and start it as an executable file. Those are the policies. Every securable object has a policy and a level. Every process has an integrity level, and they just get compared. So let's say I wanted to go and write a new file. This is such a great file. And I went to save it. And we'll go ahead and just drop it in documents, and we'll call it greatfile.txt. And then it will go ahead and give me an error message. Now, where were we saving that? We're saving it in my documents. What does the error messages suggest to me? Would you like to try save that in documents folder instead? This is why you can't believe error dialogs. They always lie to you. Because they never figured some idiot would be launching Notepad in low integrity, so it'll bring me right over to documents, and I'll try again, and it'll just sort of give me an infinite loop of, hey, how about documents? Oh, that didn't work? Well, how about documents? Oh, still didn't work, and we can click this all day. And in fact, that's what we'll be doing the rest of the session, is clicking this over and over. So how can I do that? That's no write-up. So the documents, by default, if you don't label, is going to start at medium no write-up. And I'm trying to write to it, so it's blocked. I, Chris Jackson, can write to my documents because they belong to me. I, untrusted Notepad, can't because of integrity levels. A trust decision based upon trust, not based on identity. Now, if I were to go in and go into documents, let's go into documents, and we'll make a new text document, and we'll call this awesomesauce.txt, because why not? And we'll go back to this Notepad, and let's go ahead and open. Yeah, I don't need to save that. We're going to open from documents, awesome sauce, and we opened it. Now, how do I know that that was actually something that was in there? Well, let's actually open this in a higher integrity and save it. And now, if I go back to my untrusted Notepad and reopen Awesome Sauce, I'm able to read it. It's no write-up. I can read up. And in fact, that's the reason why they call it mandatory integrity control and not mandatory privacy control. We have the ability to mark it as no read-up also, and you can, and I personally choose to, for my Quicken file, which is the one and only file I have that has any meaningful value to me. But if we put it on everything by default, guess what happens? All kinds of stuff breaks, right? And that's always the security choice, right? We can make your system incredibly secure if we put it in a bunker and cover it in concrete. But it's not very usable, right? And that's one of the decisions that we had to make, is we default to no read up. Now, what I can do is I can change the level or the policy. So if I go in here, I'm going to use, let me go to the documents folder, and I'm going to use a tool called CHML, which is written by Mark Manassi. I don't know if you guys know him. He speaks a lot to tech eds in North America and in Europe. And he wrote this tool, and I'm lazy, so I'm just using it. So I'm going to chumel against awesome sauce, and I'm going to mark it as being low integrity. And now that it's low integrity, let's go ahead and reopen it, right? And I'm able to open this file just fine, and now I can save it. Now I could remark it as medium integrity, so let's just change that to M. And now let's try awesome sauce 2. Now let's try to save it, and now we're back to access denied. So that's integrity levels, right? So the next level is now let's take this identity, let's split your identity to help you be safer, and let's stagger you by how much we trust stuff. What can we do next? Well, we had one little other thing we needed to guard against, and that's the fact that we don't only communicate through files. In fact, the way that Windows works is through this whole concept called window messages. Now, how many of you know about window messages and have actually written Petzold-style code that goes through and does a message loop? Right? Not a whole lot of people, a couple of folks, right? Either who have grayer hair than most of us or less hair, right? And so, like me, right? I don't have a whole lot of hair left. We haven't had to do that for a long time, but I remember Windows began with what we used to call Petzold, right? Petzold-style code, which is just sit there and read the messages. So I wanted to illustrate what that does for everyone who's not quite as elderly as me to showcase it. So what I'm using here is a tool from Visual Studio called Spy++. This is going to show me every single window. And what's interesting is that lots and lots and lots of things are windows. Windows are the sources to which you can send messages. And I'm going to go ahead and use this little spy tool. And this is actually, I don't know if Mark got the idea from this or what, but I'm going to look at the messages that are sent. So there's lots of windows here. Every one of these buttons is a window. The edit control is a window, and they are the target of messages, and mouse movement, and keyboard down and keyboard up is messages. Look at how chatty Windows is. Have you ever done that? It's really very interesting when you start thinking about architecturally how it works. Because one of the features, I'm going to sort of deviate from security just for a moment because it's visibly right in front of us. Wow, that's not really readable, is it? What does it mean for Windows messages in terms of performance? One of the features we added in Vista that people actually started liking in Windows 7 is a feature called the Desktop Window Manager. How the Desktop Window Manager works is all of your windows render to an off-screen bitmap, and then the manager composites them into your screen. So if you push a window in front of another window, it doesn't affect the off-screen bitmap at all. You don't have to redraw it. If you turn that off, as was the only option you had in Windows XP, every time you move a window in front of another window, you have to send a message to everything behind it, hey, go redraw yourself. And that churns a lot of CPU to go through and call every single app and redo it. So you end up with some really significant perf gains in terms of how windows behave. It's this architectural side note of what's happening. So window messages, that's how we communicate what's happening. And guess what happens if you're not careful with window messages? So if I have a bad app, and I put them in a sandbox, like you're in a sandbox, you can't go right to this file, what's the bad app going to do? How do I get out of my sandbox? How do I elevate my privilege? Well, he can just go to the window manager and say, I would like to get the handle to that window. Oh, what window? Oh, give me the window called explorer.exe. Get me the start button. I know what that is. It's on every system. I can find it everywhere. And be like, okay, here's the handle of that start button. And then you'll go and you'll click the start button, and then you'll start typing, right? So click or WM, right mouse down. You know, I don't want to get too mundane here, but start driving the UI. You can absolutely do that. How do we protect against that? And that's what user interface privilege isolation will do, is that it allows us to start to protect against that. So now I can say, oh, you can't get there. Now, I've got a more elaborate demo, but in an hour I didn't have time for it, so I figured I'd show a demo that lots of people have probably seen before. So let's go ahead and launch an elevated command prompt. So here we go again. And then let's get here's a little Explorer thing. How many of you who administer devices have ever done something like this? A couple folks, right? We've got a lot of complaints about this early on. And then you go to do this to your elevated window because you want to save some typing because we're all lazy, and notice that nothing happens. Drag and drop is implemented by window messages. What happens is with UIPI, if your integrity level of your process is lower than where you're trying to send it to, with a couple of exceptions, they do not get sent. They just get blocked. They just disappear into the ether. No one even knows it happened. They just go away. And that's what happens here. When I did a drag and drop, it sent a window message to this elevated thing. It's running it high. And the window manager said, yeah, I'm not giving that to it. It's not getting there. Right? And you can sort of see that that starts to block the backdoor, the elevation of privileges for how you get there. So this is all Vista stuff, right? We spent a long time getting up to speed, but these concepts, really, people still don't understand, and that's why we still talk about them, right? And when I say they don't understand, let's talk about one specific feature, right, an aspect of design that's impacted by this architecture we just discussed. So we know window messages are blocked moving upwards. A very common paradigm is, let's reduce prompts. So by reducing prompts, it's all about how do we just prompt when we need to, so we separate out the code that needs elevation from the rest of the UI so I don't block everything from you, just the dangerous stuff, until you prove that you have the permission to do that. Now, if one of the code patterns you can potentially use for that is to have an elevated COM component, which gives you a communication mechanism. You elevate that process, and you tell it, hey, go do this work for me, and if that gets approved, then the work can happen. Right? Make sense? I can sort of quickly sketch out that design pattern and say, you know what, here's non-elevated, right? So here we are in medium, and here's high. So I create process. So here's process one, and then I create my elevated process one, and then I use COM to talk back and forth. And I have my elevated process do the dirty work. If I don't have permission to start the elevated process, I can still see my program. It's a really common design pattern. The thing is, if I'm actually driving this from UI, to be safe, my UI should be elevated also to give me the benefits of UIPI. Make sense? Architecturally, that's kind of the right way to do it. Let's see if we can find someone who has written some code that doesn't do it. So I told you earlier that changing the system time is an admin level permission, and rightly so. Let's take a look here at whoever implemented this changing the system time applet. Let's see what this guy is running at. So included amongst the people who don't understand all of the architectural intricacies of UAC include developers from the Windows team itself, because they're running an admin level applet with a medium level UI. And this conversation still happens all the time. This really is difficult stuff. I still learn new stuff and new intricacies of this all the time. So it's okay to still talk about it, even though it's not hot and Windows 8 only, because it is so different from any other commercial operating system out there. So that's why we talk about it. So this turns out to be foundational for what we do in Windows Store applications, right? Or what we used to call Metro applications until we got told that because some tiny, completely unrelated company happens to have the word Metro somewhere in their name, that no one else can ever use it between now and the end of time for reasons that I cannot explain to you. But we package up. So here's a Windows Store application. It's my Link application. Guess what? We are packaging this up. It's slow. Every single Windows Store application starts off at low integrity. They're all untrusted. And it's foundational. It is so foundational, in fact, that if you turn off UAC and thereby lose not only split tokens, but integrity levels and UIPI and everything else and the app compat goodies that come along, all of that goes away without the ability to have low integrity, we just stop running Windows Store apps. It's so foundational to what we do. Now, why? What are we trying to accomplish with this? Here's the problem with Windows applications in general. If you go to the internet and download a random Windows application, what do you think are the odds that it either has or is exclusively malware in a random internet download? It's about 60%, 60 to 70. Most of it out there, right? There's so much, but of course, the bad guys just post a lot of stuff, right? They have a lot of fishing hooks out there. You can't trust apps anymore, right? And so you think of the beauty of the platform. Why is Windows so good? Because I have so much stuff on it. Why is Windows so dangerous? Because there's so much bad stuff on it, and I can't tell the difference. How do you make a platform that lets me tell the difference? So we start off by saying, sandbox it all. And that's foundational, because if you can't have a trusted app, better not to have apps. Particularly if they're going to start coming through from all kinds of sources. So let's put them in a sandbox. But that runs us into the next problem, which is, great, if they're all in a sandbox, they're all in the same sandbox. So great, I've just put you in a cesspool, but everything's in the cesspool. All I've done is, you know, low is the new medium. And that doesn't help me. So I need to take low and start putting up dividers between them so that low can't mess around with the other lows, because everything's running in there, particularly if I'm running on a Windows that doesn't have, that's not Windows Pro, it's a Windows RT or whatever we call that thing. That needs to have dividers between them. So what are those dividers and what do they look like? And incidentally, as a side note, while I wait for Visual Studio to kick up here, another thing that's sort of worth noting is when you look at how we test Windows, we do exactly no testing with UAC disabled. We have no clue what happens. There have been bugs filed against random things. There's like one side effect in Internet Explorer. Internet Explorer behaves very weirdly in some situations, and we had no idea. Why? Because we don't look. So if you turn it off, you're looking at something where we don't know what's going to happen. We have no clue. So let's go ahead and get into some code. Like I said, I'm going to try and make it clear for even people who don't read code. But I wanted to kind of clarify exactly how we start to implement this concept of let's go ahead and write to these files. So I've written this application. It's not the world's most sophisticated application. I just took a sample and I just threw a few buttons on it because I'm lazy like that. And the first thing I did was I tried to write a file directly to your documents folder. And look at what happened. It's just like, psh, I'm done. I'm out. Because all we're doing is saying, you know what, we're going to create this file in the documents library, and you don't have the ability to write there. And it just fails. It just crashes. Now, what ends up happening, in fact, if we go in with Process Explorer and take a look, we can kind of see how this works. That is Explorer. I need procmon. I think I launched the wrong one. And we're going to see exactly what happens. There we go. Okay, now we're running. So we're going to go back and we're going to launch it again. And we're going to see what happens. So we called in through the Windows API, the Windows RT or Windows Runtime API, to see what happens. And we tried to create a file that's called the file name, which is sample1.dat. Let's go take a look for that. So if we start filtering this and take a look and see, show me everything where the path contains sample. That's awesome. I don't need registry keys. So let's just go to the file. And we can see, yeah, we've got some samples. Oh, we didn't even get there. It just got whacked down. Well, let's go ahead and see what happens if we add the permission. So if I go into the properties here, that's not what I want. Let's see if I can. I'll fast forward past it because I'm running short on time. What actually happens, and we can see if we enable the documents privilege, which by the way you shouldn't do, everything goes through a broker. So the new Windows APIs will always say, hey, listen, we can enforce this by having a process that's allowed to, and you ask the broker. And what's happening here is the broker is saying, no, you don't have this capability. Right? If we look at the process itself, I'll get it launched again, and take a look at the process. I find file access, here it is. There will be entries for all of the capabilities that are there. One of the capabilities you can add is the documents library capability. This one doesn't have it. So the broker said no. So it makes a call into that broker and it gets denied. Now what happens from a security perspective is, well, what if it's not obeying the rules? So the rules say go through the broker. What if they try to go around it? And you actually can write code that will try to directly write it to that file. So here I write it to, you know, D documents, right? I can write it to C as well. Let me go ahead and save that and rebuild it. And we'll go ahead and I need to redeploy it. Wow, that's taking an awfully long time. Okay, we'll fast forward past that. What will actually happen is it will get an access denied. So we'll just go ahead and show the access denied. It's not created, right? So this one's looking for the wrong file path because I wrote this on a machine that had multiple hard drives. We'll get access denied. And if we start getting under the covers, we'll notice it's going to have the access denied because of integrity level. But if we then drop the integrity level to where it's allowed, then we're going to hit another block, which is we specifically do an enforcement based upon your app container SID. So the app containers are a concept that are special cased in Windows. Every single application has its own identity. So when you look at how applications and code having identity have evolved, starting in Windows Vista, every service had an identity. Starting with Windows 8 applications, every Windows 8 application has an identity. So in the file, in the access check API, we actually check, do you as an app container have permission to write here, or did someone go in and grant something else? So if I go into the documents folder and find this, I can go into the security tab and see what's allowed here. And one thing I can potentially do, if I go into advanced and I add something new, I can select a principal and I'm going to pick a new location. This will take approximately 1,800 years to burrow underneath the Pacific Ocean back to Redmond, Washington until I can finally escape it because that's an awesome default. I can go in and add this concept of all app containers, or I can add permission for any specific app container, but that is explicitly enforced. So the app container SID as a concept is where we can go in and start to build the boundaries between them. Not only do you have to have permission at being low, you have to have permission as the identity of the application. This application, incidentally, this identity is based upon the name of the app. So if I go in and check names, I can actually go in and see the all app container SID. If I had something that I wanted to allow everything to go in there, let me just find everything on my device and I can see all application packages. All app containers can go there, or any one individual app container can go there in terms of permissions. That's how we build those dividing lines, based upon the identity of the application. The other thing that we do to help build that is we then start to isolate out the objects that exist in there. So if I go back into Process Explorer and take a look at what's happening here, I can change this lower view and show all of the handles. Whoops, view, lower pane view, handles, and go back to File Explorer or File Access, there we go, and see that I've made this event, and my event, all of these events, and here's the one that I created, rather than existing in the root namespace, they get the SID, the identity of the app container, prepended to the event itself, so that now those synchronization objects also get isolated to the particular application. And so in doing so, we can start to build partitions. And when we start to think about it, right, there really are two reasons why I think this matters. One is from a compatibility perspective. If you're still thinking in the context of identity and groups is what it's all about, you're missing a lot of the depth. Think about it. Right? If I have an identity for a service, what could people be doing with their code? What kind of apps could they write? If I am an antivirus, who needs to write signatures? The update service. And nobody else, particularly not the bad guys. You can ACLe it to make that happen now, because services have an identity. Applications, if they are Windows 8 Windows Store applications, have an identity, and you can ACLe them and set permissions for them to do that. It's capabilities. Number two, unlike any other platform out there, by default, everything lives in a sandbox. You don't have to go out and buy good and stick everything in there and hope that they make the experience your users want. Because that influences sandbox, and a pretty good one, right? A lot of people use it. It's really popular. But you suddenly start to have some freedoms that weren't there before because everything starts to live in a sandbox, and it all is enforced by the same very consistent mechanism. So hopefully you enjoyed the tour. I know it was a bit accelerated because we had 1 hour instead of 75 minutes, so we missed a little bit of the gore and the guts of what was going on, but not too much. I squeezed in as much juicy stuff as I can. With that, I've taken an extra minute of your time, for which I thank you for sticking around. And I do hope this was useful, and I'm happy to entertain any questions if you want to come up and have a chat. So thanks again for coming, and we'll see you next time.